I solved a big snack problem in our household in a very simple way. My children love eating berries, and so do I, for not just the taste, but the vitamins and nutrients, fiber, all the good stuff we want on a regular basis. The problem? We all know what it's like to pick up a berry we just bought, and it's already growing fuzz in the fridge. So I've switched to buying frozen berries. And a favorite I look for now is Washington Red Raspberries. Did you know 90% of frozen red raspberries in the United States are grown in Washington State and mostly grown on family farms who harvest them during peak ripeness and clean and freeze on location, sealing in all that freshness, taste, and great nutritional value. So now I use frozen raspberries in our yogurt or smoothies as a sweet treat. And I love that this means I can support local American farmers and have a healthy snack for my family that withstands the test of time. You can find Washington Red Raspberries at your local grocery store or Costco. And how do you know you're getting the good stuff? Well, you just take a peek at the packaging and look for product of the U.S., and then you'll know you're on the right path. Oh, and if you want some fun recipes and more information, go to redraz.org. That's redraz.org. And you're going to find recipes, health tips, retail locations, everything you need to make frozen Washington red raspberries a regular part of your routine. Overall, it's just a smarter choice. Hello from the Heartland. My name is Jenna, and this is Smarter News. News when it matters and why it matters. Our Smarter series features unique people who help us think and live smarter. This is the big headline. There's a new coronavirus, also known as COVID-19, that's igniting a lot of concern around the world. How big of a deal is it? How do we stay healthy? What should we watch for? These are the basic questions that Dr. Michael Perry will answer for you today. Dr. Perry is a physician and director of the Infectious Disease Department and Microbiology Lab at Stanford Hospital in Connecticut. With experience spanning 4 decades, he provides an incredible wealth of knowledge on every aspect of this story. From whether or not this virus was engineered in a Chinese lab to if we should all invest in a mask. If you met Dr. Perry in person, as I have, he is instantly warm, inviting, and compassionate. He has an incredible smile, and he's one of those people who you know is really, really smart, but doesn't make you feel silly for asking basic questions. He's also a father, and not just any father. A gold star dad. And that's how I know him. His stepson, Brian Bill, was a friend of mine, a decorated Navy SEAL who trained and worked with my husband. Brian was killed in action in Afghanistan in 2011. So Dr. Perry knows professionally and personally what's a red alert and what's not. His family has served our country, his community, and now Smarter News. And for this, we are so grateful. As we started our conversation, I was relieved to learn that a lot of the same questions we've been asking, Dr. Perry's been getting from members of his own team. So let's get started. I think I am relieved to hear that healthcare workers and doctors have some of the same questions that we have, Dr. Perry, that you're getting some questions from some of your team that are very similar to the questions that I'm going to ask you from Smarter News. And it seems that there is some unknown when it comes to this new coronavirus. What's your take in general about it?
Well, it's a completely unknown virus. It's a new virus. We have models to look at. We have SARS, which happened in 2009. We have MERS, which has been ongoing for the last 5 years. They are both coronaviruses. They're both animal viruses that have jumped into humans. They have different biology, so that SARS was here for a three-month period in the winter months and then ended. MERS continues to smolder in the Middle East over a period of 3 to 4 to 5 years. So they're very different, same sort of virus, but very different epidemiologies. And so I'm not sure, and nobody's sure, how to predict what's going to happen with this particular coronavirus.
When you say that it jumps from animal to person, can you explain that in some detail? Because we've heard that repeatedly over the last several weeks, but I haven't heard a really easy explanation for how that happens.
Well, these viruses are pretty widespread in the animal kingdom. particularly in mammals, but also in reptiles and bats and a variety of other animals. They are adapted to those animals and generally don't appear in humans. However, these viruses all have the ability to change a little bit to become more likely to infect other species. And in China or cultures where animals become food, wild animals become food, you see these viruses begin to adapt to a different population of prey. And that prey, in this situation, is a human host. The virus changes a little bit, becomes more communicable to humans, and jumps from an animal to a human. And then, because humans have never seen this virus before, they're completely naive immunologically, and the virus can spread because there's no defense in the population.
So when we've seen in the past that a coronavirus has spread from, I believe it was from bats to camels or bats to cats, then is it that the human host actually ingests those animals in order for it to spread to a human, or is it simply by being in close proximity with them?
It's not really clear. I think most of it is close proximity through aerosol in these live animal markets where animals are killed, eviscerated, plucked, cut up, and you get an aerosol, and those viruses are then breathed in. It's a respiratory virus, so it's more likely to be inhaled than it is to be ingested. And I think that's probably the root, although there's certainly debate about that.
So we do know that there are some unknowns, and I'm using some of our audience questions to fuel our conversation because so few of us, Dr. Perry, have someone that we could call and just ask some of the more simple but also interesting questions about the unknowns here. And several of our audience members have heard the theories that somehow this virus was manufactured in a lab somewhere, and that's how it spread. I was just curious your opinion. I'm sure you've seen some of these theories in the media. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I've seen those comments. I think there's really no merit to them. These viruses are well known. They exist in animals. They can easily mutate and jump to humans. There's absolutely nothing to suggest that this was a manufactured problem. And even if it was a manufactured problem, it still could happen in nature. It's not unusual. We see this all the time. Look at influenza. Influenza in humans, these pandemic strains are derived from birds or pigs or both. And so that these viruses live in animal hosts and easily jump to humans in the right environment.
Interesting. So Mary had a great question, and she was asking if we could help her understand why the spread of this particular virus is so much more alarming than others. Or is it to you, Dr. Perry? Do you find this more alarming than others?
Well, I think the very fact that it happened and spread in the human population where there is no immunity and has generated 80,000 plus cases is obviously alarming. I mean, the very fact of it is alarming. It is very similar to what happens with influenza. The viruses produce the same kind of illness. You can't distinguish the clinical illness between influenza and coronavirus. They're different viruses. They have a slightly different outcome. It looks like this coronavirus has a little bit higher mortality rate, and people get sicker than they do with flu in general. But you have to understand that, in 80,000 patients that have gotten coronavirus, and that's a minimum number, there's 2,000 to 3,000 deaths. But that means that there's 77,000 patients that recover from this. And there's probably a huge number of people that are relatively asymptomatic. That means they maybe just have a cold, a little bit of a cough, and they recover and are never diagnosed. And so the conventional wisdom is that that 80,000 is the tip of the iceberg, and most people completely recover and don't ever get diagnosed. And that's very similar to what we see with influenza.
So that's interesting. We're hearing now for the very first time from the CDC that they believe, and this could change, by the way, by the time someone listens to this interview, but as of Wednesday night, they believe that there's potentially the first case of community spread of this new coronavirus in a person in California. Can you explain to us what does community spread mean and why is it significant?
Well, human-to-human spread is what potentiates an epidemic or a pandemic. If you just get spread from an animal to a human and it's a dead-end spread, then there is no epidemic. There is no spread. The fact that we've got 80,000 cases described in China, and this is not due to animal to human, this is human to human spread. That is what's responsible for an epidemic and a pandemic. We know that happens in China. We know that's going to happen wherever a human is in close contact with another. I think actually the California spread that was just commented on is actually the second one. There has been person-to-person spread in California, in the United States. If you come from China and you happen to develop coronavirus and you're living with your spouse, it's very likely that your spouse will get it, just as it is with influenza. So they're both person-to-person spread, and that's what's responsible for the pandemic.
And so in this particular case, they're saying that the exposure that this person had is unknown, so that they didn't come into contact with someone that was traveling to China that they know of, right? That they know of, and right, that potentially they weren't around somebody else with it. But as your description that you've told us over the last few minutes, it might have been difficult to even know if they came in contact with someone with the virus if that other person had symptoms that were relatively minor.
Absolutely correct. And that, of course, is the problem. How do you prevent 100% of these cases? Because so many people have minimal symptoms and yet might be contagious. And you don't identify these people. You don't know they have coronavirus. You don't know they have influenza. How many times have I personally, as a physician, seen a patient who comes in with influenza? They have no history of contact with the flu. Nobody at home has the flu, but they've gotten the flu. So they picked it up in the subway. They picked it up from a doorknob or a handrail and touched their mouth or nose with their hands that are contaminated. The same thing is happening with coronavirus. And so although you try to identify cases and try to quarantine or isolate them, because of the nature of the relatively asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic patient, it's impossible to totally prevent spread.
Well, you mentioned something really important, and we have a ton of questions about this. And quite frankly, this has been one of the big questions that I've been searching for an answer about, Dr. Perry, about how this virus is spread. And I understand there's a lot of unknowns. However, the question about surface spreading. So if I touch a doorknob, like you mentioned, or a railing, how likely is it for me to be able to get this virus, especially because there's so many different items that come into our country from China? This seems to be one of the major unknowns that people want an answer to. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's very unlikely for viruses to be imported from China on an inanimate surface. But we know that influenza and even the common cold coronavirus can live on a surface for a day or two. Most of the surface contamination, let's say from influenza, which is of course much more well described, is 12 to 24 hours on a hard surface. That virus can be picked up on your hands, and then you can inoculate yourself by putting your hands in your eyes, your nose, or your mouth, those mucous membranes that are susceptible, and that's how you acquire influenza, which is why hand washing is so important during the flu season and why keeping your hands away from your face is so important. One of the values of mask use in the influenza season is not that it actually prevents you from inhaling a virus, but that it keeps your hands out of your mouth and nose, which is the major portal of entry of a virus that might be on your hands, that in self-inoculation that you can minimize by washing your hands, keeping your hands away from your mouth and face and eyes, or wearing a mask.
We had a ton of questions about masks as well. Is this something that the American family should consider, should invest in, should use when they are traveling?
Well, masks are of value for brief periods of time in a very close person-to-person setting, whether it's in a hospital or an airplane or another setting. Masks have been shown to diminish the risk of transmission for short periods. They tend to get damp after 15 or 20 minutes, and then they become ineffective. So they're not a panacea, and they're generally used in specific situations with specific exposure risks. Walking around the street wearing a mask is probably of zero value. Wearing a mask in an airport in an open room is probably of zero value. In an airplane cabin passenger area where you're sitting and somebody might be coughing and sneezing next to you, a mask is probably of value for short periods. But once that mask gets wet, it doesn't effectively filter.
So if you were traveling around the United States right now, would you wear a mask on an airplane?
I think the risk of coronavirus in the U.S. at this time is so infinitesimally small, there is no role for mask use in the U.S.
So Kat had an interesting question. She was just asking in general whether or not it was safe to travel, whether it was domestically or internationally. We had a few questions about that, about whether or not people should really think about changing their plans.
Yeah. Well, domestic travel is fine. I don't see any risk at this point in time with domestic travel. There's never such thing as zero risk, but it's infinitesimally small at this point in time in the U.S. I've been asked a lot of questions about travel to the Caribbean. There's no issues with travel to the Caribbean at this point. I had a physician friend who was traveling to southern Italy. A question, and this was yesterday, should he go, should he not go? I said, go. There's no issue right now in southern Italy. And the longer you wait, the more problem there might be. I think one needs to follow what's going on in the world. Look at the CDC website, the Johns Hopkins website. There are lots of resources that tell you where the risk is. The risk right now is airline travel or surface travel to China and South Korea. Those are level 3 alerts from the CDC. So any non-mandatory travel to China or South Korea should be canceled. There are medium-risk countries where elective travel probably should be deferred, and that's Japan, Iran, and Northern Italy. The risks are all relative, but in the U.S. at this point, domestic travel is not an issue.
So a few other questions came up about what we can do to proactively protect ourselves in general. And there were a few questions about immune boosting supplements, you know, whether it's vitamin C or zinc. I know these are things we hear about regularly when it comes to the common cold or even the flu. What are your thoughts on just being cognizant, maybe even taking a few extra doses, Dr. Perry, just for the heck of it? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think those extra doses won't do you any harm. I don't think they'll do you any good. I think the biggest risks for influenza, coronavirus, and the complications of those infections are constitutional issues. If you're a smoker, you're in trouble. If you're overweight or have some kind of neurological disease, and when I say overweight, I mean morbidly obese, you're in trouble because both of those conditions increase the risk of the complications of flu or any other respiratory illness. If you're otherwise healthy and you're well nourished, and you don't smoke, your risk is relatively low of the complications of influenza or coronavirus or any other circulating virus. And there are many of them out there at this time of year.
Why do you think we're getting the information that this virus is more deadly for elderly people and that it's not being seen in children? Do you believe that data right now, or do you think we'll see it equal out as we get more information? What are your thoughts about that initial reporting?
Well, obviously, as you mentioned, the reporting is based on data mainly coming out of China. We don't have firsthand data of all of the raw numbers. So I think there's a little asterisk by the data. It may not be absolutely correct. But just as with influenza, it is the patients over 60, 70, or 80 years of age that have the highest morbidity and the highest mortality. I think that's true with all respiratory viruses. Patients who are older, their immune system is weaker. They are more susceptible to pneumonia for a combination of reasons. Strength, nutrition, immune system, all of those contribute to the risk of pneumonia in people who get influenza or coronavirus. So I do believe that the older patient is at higher risk. The pediatric data, I'm not sure that I really understand at this point. Certainly in pandemic influenza, we see young people more susceptible than old people. I think we have to understand a little bit more about coronavirus in the pediatric population to make a better statement.
Interesting. And at this point, would you say that it's, you know, as a physician, if you were speaking to a family with small children, would it still be that, hey, I'm more concerned about the flu for your child or the measles for your child rather than the coronavirus at this point?
Yeah, at this time we're seeing, in our hospital, which is a relatively small community hospital, we're seeing 50 to 60 to 70 cases of influenza per week. So influenza is our biggest concern at this point. We have not seen a novel coronavirus infection, period. So our biggest concern is influenza. And so travel advice that we give is really focused on influenza more than coronavirus at this point in time.
And on that, and just a few final questions, you've been so generous, I really appreciate it. What symptoms would you be looking for in a hospital to say, you know what, I think we should maybe check this person for this new coronavirus? What would you be looking for that would be different than if a person had a cold or a bad flu?
Well, the symptoms are really no different. So it's only the epidemiologic piece of the history that clues you in. Travel, exposure, those are the history, those are the items in the history that are going to make me concerned about coronavirus, because coronavirus and influenza are exactly the same in their presentation. Cough, shortness of breath, chest pain, fever, you take a chest x-ray, there are infiltrates or areas of fluid within the lungs, which signify pneumonia. They look the same. You cannot tell the difference between the two. So really, the suspicion is going to be based on exposure and travel history. And then you have to do the test. And the test is specific for the agent that's causing the infection, whether it's influenza virus or adenovirus or RSV or coronavirus. They all produce a very, very similar illness, and you can't distinguish between each one of them.
Well, this has been really helpful. I don't know if you can hear Dr. Perry, but I have my children screaming in the background, which is the way that we're bringing home into this conversation, because this is one of those news stories that does make you, you know, makes you think about, well, what would this be like for my family? And what would it be like for my community if this took place? And we're always told that the next big pandemic is coming. So is that this? And so as we finish up here, I was just curious, this final question, what are you watching for? You know, what are the few things that you're keeping in mind as this story develops where you see, well, you know what, hey, this could be the tipping point, or this is where my concern would grow?
I think that clusters of cases that are diagnosed as coronavirus in a community is going to be alarming in the U.S. We know that with SARS, that there was a condition called a super spreader. And these are individuals who are infected with a coronavirus and they produce huge amounts of virus, and that can be spread to a large number of people. Most people probably can infect one or two other people, but these super spreaders can infect 100 other people because of the amount of virus they shed. So that occurrence would be alarming to us from an infectious disease perspective. The other thing I need to say is that, you know, we all rely on the CDC, and the CDC has become very politicized, which is, I think, inappropriate on both sides of the aisle. CDC is an absolutely spectacular organization that is a world-renowned resource for how to manage and prevent and control epidemics and pandemics. And so we as infectious disease doctors rely an awful lot on what the CDC is finding, recommending, and advising. And so we all sort of march to the same drum so that we are consistent in our message. For people that want more information, the CDC has wonderful public pages that can be accessed at cdc.gov. And there's a ton of information there that's readable, understandable, and very helpful for both the healthcare industry and also, you know, the general population. So I would encourage anybody that has more questions and needs clarification to go to that site and just search and read and learn.
That's great advice, Dr. Perry. That's exactly what we tell everybody on Smarter News. Go directly to the source. And that's a good place to stop. Dr. Perry, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Quick, concise, nonpartisan Smarter News, a refuge from the storm. I'm Jenna. Thank you for choosing Smarter.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.